Welcome to The Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast series. Bruegel is a think tank based in Brussels. In its latest forecast, published last Monday, the European Commission is expecting growth to be 2.7% for 2022 and 2.3% for 2023. Inflation, on the other hand, is at 6.1% for this year, but it will come back at 2.7% next year. Since the last forecasting round published by the ECB on the 10th of March, we have seen, therefore, an additional 1 percentage point or 100 basis points on inflation for this year and 1 percentage point reduction in growth for this year. These are big revisions in such a short time span, and they, of course, reflect the implications of the war in Ukraine that unravel very slowly. My name is Maria Demergis. I'm the Deputy Director at Bruegel. And here with me to discuss these issues, both from the EU perspective, but also from the US, are Megan Green, who is a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Hi, Megan. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Gregory Claes, who is a senior fellow here at Bruegel. Hi, Gregory. Nice to see you again. Long time.
Hello.
So we've seen the forecast that were published last Monday from the European Commission. I mean, a huge revision downward for growth and a huge revision upward for inflation. 100 basis points in the space of a month and a half are by all means huge revisions, right? Gregory, perhaps I can start with you because we're really talking about the EU number first, and then I'll go to Megan, who could give us more of a US perspective. Could we really be talking about the possibility of stagflation given those revisions?
Yeah, as you already mentioned, I think it's right to say that we are in a peculiar situation where we have lower growth and higher inflation. And therefore, some people have been inclined to call that stagflation. But I don't know if that can be characterized as stagflation. It's a difficult concept. It's true that we have low growth and above inflation target. But if you compare it, for instance, to the real stagflation period, which is the end of the 70s, early 80s, it's kind of a very different situation. I looked at the numbers actually for France and Germany in 1975. And if you look at them at that time, when we had the first oil shock, we had like very negative growth, which is not what we are going to have today. As you say, growth is still forecasted at 2.7% this year. In 1975, we had like minus 1%. And inflation is also much lower than it was in 1975. I looked at the number for France, for instance, and it was like 13%. The number for France today is like 5%. Okay, France is on the lower end of the spectrum, but it's still much lower than it was in the 70s and early 80s. So even though, yeah, in one sense, it's true that it's low growth, high inflation, but it's very different from the stagflation period of the 70s.
That's very good. Before I go to ask Megan whether there is the possibility of stagflation in the US, Megan, you have a sense of the numbers for the US?
Yeah, so both inflation and growth are much higher in the US than in the Eurozone. So we're probably looking at growth of around 4% for the year, which is well above potential, but a pretty significant slowdown from last year when we grew over 5%. On the inflation side, again, we're higher than the Eurozone. So inflation exceeded 8% in April in the US. The Fed is hoping that it will come down to around 3% by the end of the year. I think that might be a little bit optimistic. I think we could see inflation between 3% and 4% by the end of this year. So it should come down fairly significantly. And there are all kinds of uncertainties around that forecast, but it will remain well above the Fed's target, which is broadly an overall average of 2% inflation. So the Fed is in a tougher bind. The Fed, I think the US is much further away from stagflation than the Eurozone is. I actually think stagflation is kind of a base case scenario for the Eurozone, if you define it as weak growth and high inflation. For the US, I think we have stronger growth, but also stronger inflation. If you look at how the US versus the Eurozone have rebounded from the pandemic, you know, the US has closed its output gap already. That's not true in most Eurozone economies. We had much bigger stimulus, but actually the labor force has healed completely in the Eurozone, and that's not the case in the US. And that underpins some differences in the inflation that we're seeing in both regions.
Yeah, a lot of interesting things you've picked on, Megan. Perhaps I can pick on a couple. First of all, I kind of see your definition of stagflation. And I think the interesting thing is not so much whether we are in a 1970s type of stagflation, like Gregory, you said, but this idea that actually growth and inflation will be going in opposite direction. I think that's really the issue here, right? Now, you see that in the US, you have much more textbook type of movements, co-movements between growth and inflation, whereas actually now the difficulty in the Eurozone is that, you know, growth and inflation may be moving in opposite direction, which of course means that, and here, come back to you, Gregory, the policy, of course, is in a sort of an awkward position, right? I mean, I think we need to spend a little bit of time on doing that. But before I come to that, also, you mentioned, Megan, the issue of the labor market having healed in the Eurozone. I think, what is your sense in terms of why this is? I mean, this is a guided question, eh? Because, I mean, the policies that were applied were actually quite different. I don't know if you wanted to comment on exactly why is it that the labor force is much more healed in the Eurozone than in the U.S.?
Yeah, sure. So the labor force participation rate in the Eurozone has rebounded to where it was before the pandemic. And that's not the case in the US. The labor force participation rate remains well below where it was pre-pandemic. And so there is this big mystery about what happened to the American worker. They didn't just disappear. So why have they dropped out? But I think the underlying reason for that is the different approach that the US versus the Eurozone took during the pandemic, where the Eurozone highlighted and prioritized maintaining a connection between workers and employers, so using short-term working schemes and furlough. Whereas in the US, we actually have short-term working schemes. Most people don't know that. They exist in the US at the state level in many states. They're just not widely used. And so instead, we tend to just lay everyone off and then support them on the other end and provide more in terms of unemployment insurance and benefits, whereas the Eurozone tries to keep that connection. And it's hard to say which system is better. I actually think each is better for each economy. So the US tends to have a much more flexible labor market. And so you can lay people off and know that when activity returns, they can find a job fairly easily. In many Eurozone economies, the labor market is more rigid. So laying people off could be disastrous because it could take years for them to find another job. And so maintaining a connection does have some benefits in a more rigid labor market. But I think that explains not only why the labor force participation rate hasn't rebounded in the US, but also it explains what we're seeing in terms of wage growth. I think everyone knows that the best time to negotiate for a higher salary is when you're about to start a new job. That's when your leverage is the highest. And so we had all these workers who were laid off and then went and found jobs, and they were in a great position to negotiate for higher wages. Whereas in the Eurozone, if workers were still attached to employers, it's much harder to negotiate for a bigger salary. And so there's much more wage growth in the US, though it's starting to decelerate, than in the Eurozone. And of course, every central banker is terrified that you'll end up in this kind of wage price spiral that will cause inflation to get out of control. And that looks much more likely. It's actually not my base case, but it's more likely in the US than it is in the Eurozone because of these differences in approaches to the labor market during the pandemic.
Well, I think we need to spend a bit of time thinking about policy, what policy needs to do. But before that, can we perhaps come back to you, Gregory, and think a little about the war and how we are witnessing it here in Europe when it comes, of course, to forecasts and to what it will do to the outlook? What are the inputs to the inflation forecast and to the growth forecast, and how the uncertainty that comes from the war is kind of viewed from Europe, which is, of course, much closer to the war than the US?
Yeah, I think the war in Ukraine basically changed the outlook for inflation, because before that, a lot of people were expecting very temporary inflation caused by the end of the COVID crisis, supply bottlenecks in Europe and in China, etc. And now it has become much more durable, in the sense that we are now facing like very consecutive shocks. As you like to call it, we are facing like a perma crisis, it seems, in Europe. And therefore, it makes the situation much more difficult for the ECB. Before that, they were just expecting a bump in inflation. Now that it's become more durable, the situation is much more difficult for the ECB. They are in a very difficult situation, especially because monetary policy in Europe cannot do much about the current inflation bump, even if it's more durable, because it's still largely exogenous. It mainly comes from energy prices due to the war and to the sanctions. And now food prices also, because a lot of grain come from Ukraine and Russia. So therefore, the ECB needs to do something, it seems, because inflation is well above target. But we don't know if increasing rate or ending QE will have a real impact. It looks like more like we are going to have like increasing rates more for psychological reason in a way. Like it's really to ensure that the ECB keep its credibility high and ensures that inflation expectations are not disanchored, more than about the real effect of rate increase.
Can I ask you, Gregory, I mean, so we had actually Philip Lane here a couple of weeks ago, in which he went at tremendous lengths to show us the numbers, because obviously the numbers are very important for building up a case one way or the other. And actually what he showed us in sort of in very granular terms is that, you know, the indications at the euro area, because country cases could be quite different, but at the euro area level, the numbers of what you described as the second round effects effectively, right, they're still not there. They're not visible. You know, Megan gave us a few explanations about the wage growth, but, you know, it's still not there. All the components of inflation, they're not atypical by comparison to any other, sort of going back in history. The only thing that is atypical is, of course, energy. And as you say, what can the ECB do about energy? I mean, they cannot do anything sort of, by means of monetary policy. So what is the real problem here? Could it be that, you know, by the time the numbers become visible, it might be too late to do something about it? Is that what you meant by the ECB being in a difficult position?
No, I fully agree with you with what Philip Lane said and what he showed us. Basically, inflation expectations are not over the roof. They went from 1.8% to 2.1%. It's basically nothing. It's still around the target. And as Megan said, the situation in the labor market is very different. We are expecting wages to grow at like 3%, which is not far from the inflation target, especially if you take into account possibly productivity growth. So we are still at wages and expectations that are fully compatible with the ECB's target. So in that sense, there is no need for rush. And here, I think, yeah, Megan explained it very well. I think the situation is very different in Europe and in the US, where in the US, it was inflation is really fueled by the fiscal stimulus, by high demand, etc. Here, it's not fueled by high demand. Consumption and investment are still below pre-crisis levels. So it's really driven by energy. So it really put the ECB in an awkward position.
Okay, so then let's then think about the policy reaction. We could go back to the US and see Megan, what is now, what do we expect? As you said, so inflation and growth are moving much more in tandem in the US, and therefore the policy choices are a lot easier to justify. What do you expect to see from the point of view of the Fed in the next, so let's say, 6 months?
So in the US, I think it's a little bit less difficult than the ECB, but I expect that actually inflation in the US is also primarily supply driven. And there's nothing that a central bank can do about supply side issues. All central banks can do is engage in aggregate demand management so they can kill off demand. Now, this is less clearly the case in the US than in the Eurozone, because as Greg clearly stated, you know, inflation is overwhelmingly driven by energy and food costs in the Eurozone. That's not really the case in the US. About half of our inflation is driven by energy and food costs, the rest by other things. And it is very likely that that's because of the huge fiscal stimulus measures that we had in response to the pandemic in the US. So you can argue that inflation is driven by demand side factors. Just looking at our real GDP growth figure last year of over 5%, that was so strong. So it could be partly demand driven. That being said, starting in the first quarter of last year already, the government was retrenching. So the fiscal impact was pretty negative. This year, the US government will be undergoing the second largest retrenchment in our history relative to the previous year. So I'd say that fiscal impulse is gone already. Some of that went into people's bank accounts in terms of stimulus checks. So in a way, the government passed the baton onto consumers in the US. That being said, consumers have been sort of burning down that financial cushion. And particularly if you look at the distribution of it, the lowest quartile of households ran out of a financial cushion in March already of this year. So that financial cushion is long gone, and you move up in terms of the quartiles from there. So the consumer is very strong still in the US, but is starting to weaken. So some of it might be demand driven, though I think most of that is behind us. And then we have the whole supply side thing as well. It's not just the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is pushing energy and food prices up in the US too. But it's also China's zero COVID policy causing all kinds of factory closures. There's nothing the Fed can do about that. And so one Fed official put it to me very honestly. He said, all we can do is engage in demand management. So we can kill off demand. That's the point of hiking rates and shrinking the balance sheet. But if it's a supply side issue, that's not really going to help that much. And we don't want to do it too much because we'll push the economy into a recession. So what we can do is hike rates and hope that we're just buying ourselves time so the supply side issues can kind of abate and sort themselves out in the meantime. And I think that's what the Fed and the ECB are both trying to do. The Fed will hike rates aggressively this year. The markets are still expecting at least 9 more rate hikes this year in terms of 25 basis point hikes. I think that among the FOMC, the rate setters at the Fed, the expectation is to try to get to neutral by the end of the year. That's 2.5%. So that reflects really aggressive hiking. And then see where we are once we get to neutral. It's worth pointing out that real rates are so incredibly negative in the US and in the Eurozone, actually, that both the Fed and the ECB have some room to hike before they're actually really tightening. And then, of course, the Fed is shrinking its balance sheet at the same time. And the implications of that on inflation and growth are much less well understood than the implications of rate moves. So I think we can expect the Fed to get rates to neutral, so 2.5% roughly. And then we'll see sort of what's happening in terms of the war and China's zero COVID policy and what growth looks like. The yield curve inverted in the US a few weeks ago for about 23 seconds, and everyone thought, oh God, a recession is coming. I don't think that's a signal that a recession is coming, but I do think it will be very difficult for the Fed to hike rates aggressively and not have unemployment tick up from incredibly low levels. And once you have unemployment start to tick up, that's a really good indicator for a recession that's coming. So I don't think we'll see a recession in the next 12 months in the US, but in the 12 months after that, I think the risk rises quite a lot.
That's interesting. So Gregory, 2.5% neutral rates for the US. What is the equivalent in the Eurozone?
It's a $1 million or €1 million question, I have to say, because as you know, the neutral rate is not observable. We need to estimate it, and estimating it in real time is almost impossible. And we know actually in Europe that relying on this non-observable variable is dangerous. We have used them a lot in our European fiscal rules, you know, the output gap, the structural deficit, etc. And it didn't help us a lot during the euro crisis and its aftermath. So relying on this first, we need to be cautious. Then where it is, it's difficult to say. If you look at market expectation for ECB rate in the long term, it's like around 2%. So it could give us an indication of where the market think the real rate is, at least in nominal terms. So it's 2%, well, let's say minus 2% inflation, because inflation expectation in the long run are still around 2% in Europe. So it's still around zero in real terms, if you believe those market expectations. It seems very low, lower than it used to be before the financial crisis. But yeah, it might be still around there.
But the nominal is at 2%. So we could still expect that, you know, the nominal, right, to reach up, right, just like in the US in there.
Yeah. So there is still a lot of space for the ECB to go neutral because they're at minus 0.5. If the nominal neutral rate is 2%, yeah, it gives them a lot of leeway to neutral. And actually, market expectations are still at around 2% at the end of 2023. So it's still quite quick. In my view, maybe markets are a bit going too strong on that front. I think the ECB will be more cautious than that. Yes, they have announced that they will increase rates this year at least twice to go to zero. But I don't know if they will reach 2% by the end of 2023. Given the Ukraine war, the slower growth, the fact that real income are affected by inflation, and especially because, not like in the US, we expect wages to be much lower. Bargaining power also in Europe is lower. So in that sense, I'm not sure that the ECB will be able to go to this 2% neutral rate, even if I don't know if the neutral rate is exactly there, but I think 2% might be a bit high.
In fact, about a couple of weeks ago, the talk was there was going to be a raise of interest rates, an increase in interest rates. In the July meeting yesterday, President Lagarde said that nothing like that before September. So I think, you know, they're very, very cautious in terms of what they're going to do about monetary policy, right? I wanted to concentrate a little bit on the difference between the EU and the US in terms of awkwardness of policymaking at the current juncture, because I think that's a very important one. And I think, you know, the magic word here for the EU is financial fragmentation. Any increase in the interest rates, particularly at high speeds, is going to pose problems in the euro area that you won't see in the US. And that, of course, is certainly in the mind of the ECB. So if you can talk a little bit about that, Greg, because I know you're working on this issue right now, so it would be nice to see First of all, are we going to see financial fragmentation if we're going to see interest rates going up? And what would be the implications of that?
But spreads have already increased, actually. If you look at the Italian spread versus Germany, it's already around like 200 basis points. So it's not as high as it was, obviously, during the euro crisis, or even the level at which it increased during the Lega five-star coalition, where there was a bit of tension with the Commission, or even in March 2020, before PEP was launched by the ECB. But it's still a high level. So spreads are indeed increasing. So it's something a bit dangerous, and something that the ECB needs to keep in mind. But actually, if you look at the press conferences, journalists are always reminding them of that. And they have already said that they are ready to do stuff in case there is fragmentation. It could be using the redemptions from the PEP program. So basically, when asset matures, they could use that to focus, for instance, to put that money more into Italian bonds or Greek bonds or whatever. But this might not be enough. So they might have to think about new tools to deal with that fragmentation.
Yeah, let's come back to that in a minute, actually. But let's bring Megan in. Megan?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, to my view, the ECB is making a colossal mistake by ending its quantitative easing program before it goes and moves rates. This is my biggest concern, is financial fragmentation, because you have this whole creative redemption idea, but there are both legal and political constraints, I think. I think it's going to be really hard for the ECB to bring down Italian spread significantly using reinvestment of the PEP. So I don't actually think that's really a solution. And then the other option you have, of course, is the OMT, which virtually no country ever wants to use. We saw that when the pandemic hit. Everybody, you know, no countries would touch that with a 10-foot pole, given the conditionality and everything. And my worry is that the only way that the ECB managed to launch QE in the first place is they could say, well, deflation is the tail risk. And now, of course, that's no longer the world that we're living in. It's quite the opposite. So it's going to be hard if spreads really start blowing out for the ECB to justify relaunching some kind of way to actually reduce financial fragmentation. So I do think that that's a real challenge for the ECB. And it's a challenge, you know, the Fed doesn't have to worry about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Gregory, yeah.
No, I fully agree with you, in particular about the redemption. The redemption are going to be really small. They are going to be like 17 to 18 billion per month. And when you look at what the ECB did at the beginning of the COVID crisis, they were spending like 90 billion per month. So I definitely agree with you that that is going to be too small of a tool to deal with that risk. So they will need to be creative again.
But can you envisage a situation in which we know that there's going to be increase in the interest rates? As you said, even if it's not justifiable like entirely on the supply side, managing the fact that we see such high expectations will require some increase in the interest rates. But if that were to also increase financial fragmentation, what else can you do? What types of tools can you use to try and at least contain it? Megan?
So, I mean, I think one thing they can do is use the RRF, the Resilience and Recovery Fund, as kind of a model for a new program they could put together under the guise of increased defense spending and funding the green transition that could help countries across the board. I mean, I think that's one way to show, look, we have a lot of money. This isn't what the ECB can do, of course. This is what fiscal authorities would have to do.
The macro.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it would, frankly, be more appropriate coming from the fiscal authorities. That's what we would want to see. It would be another form. If the RRF is used as a model, then there could be some joint issuance again, and it could be a signal that, you know, the RRF was not a one-off for one emergency. It's become a model, and maybe there's more fiscal union than we had originally thought. I think that could help, at least if spreads really started spiking in the periphery. Otherwise, I think it's just going to be too difficult for the ECB to justify another bond buying program. That's why I thought they should have left one going, even if it was really small, so that they could ramp it up in an emergency. But I think that ship has sailed, unfortunately.
Interesting. So you talk about the more the general macro coordination framework to handle the possibility of increasing spreads. But I mean, Greg, on the financial fragmentation, the ECB?
The ECB, basically, as Megan said, yeah, the tool that they have at their disposal is OMT. But as Megan also rightly pointed out, the problem of the OMT is that it's conditional. So it's more there to deal with situation where you have like unsound fiscal policies that need to be changed, and you need a memorandum of understanding to change those policies, and you need an ESM program, etc. This is not the case at the moment, actually. It's more like countries are affected by an exogenous shock. So what we need is a new form of OMT for exogenous shock. I think that would be the way the ECB could deal with it. However, the problem is more of a democratic nature, in my view, in the sense that it's difficult for the ECB to launch something without a political validation. And I think the beautiful part of OMT is that the ECB has this possible political validation, because if OMT depends on an ESM program, it means that an ESM program is actually conditional on unanimity in the Eurogroup. And therefore, basically, OMT was kind of politically validated. While if the OMT is not validated by an ESM program, then it's a bit of an awkward thing from a democratic perspective. So they need to find another way to obtain this political validation. I don't know. Maybe we could think of other ways, like based on a commission approval of sustainability or something that could be first technically approved by the commission and then maybe validated politically by the council or by the Eurogroup. There could be this kind of thing. We need to think about how to do that from an international perspective.
You know, I see Megan wants to come in, but can I just ask, what would that mean for central bank independence? I mean, if you were to have that, or is that what you wanted to say, Megan, or...
Yeah, so I think that's a big concern, although given that the ECB has all of the member states as representatives and everything has to be done with a treaty change, I actually think that the ECB needs to worry a little bit less about its independence than the Fed, which only reports to Congress effectively. So I think that's a slightly smaller concern for the Eurozone. Yeah, than it is in the U.S. There's one other tool that the ECB could use that it has used before, and that's TLTROs, dual interest rates. So what it could do is effectively step in to subsidize banks in peripheral countries, which can then go ahead and load up on sovereign debt if they want to. It's not the best option. It's certainly not the first one I would go to. But in an absolute crisis, if the ECB can't relaunch QE, can't buy up assets itself, it can basically say, we'll provide loans to Eurozone banks at deeply negative rates. So we'll subsidize things to you for specific purchases. And depending on the nature of the crisis, it could target them so that it can effectively get money to the peripheral countries' banks, which then can use it for loans for the green transition or to buy up sovereign debt if they need to, given that money is fungible. So that's one tool the ECB has used in the past, I think fairly effectively. The interest rate for loans to banks was negative, more negative than the deposit rate. So there was actually a benefit for banks, and it was a subsidy for banks, but they did it very timidly. So in a real crisis, they could cut the rate for loans to banks deeply negative, and that would be a significant subsidy, and that would generate demand for the loans, and so could be successful. I just know that the ECB doesn't really want to go there.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Gregory?
And I think it's much less effective than QE. It's much more indirect. And actually, they tried to use that also during the euro crisis, and it didn't work that well in the end. So I think QE is a much more effective way to deal with fragmentation. However, if I may come back to what Megan was saying, I think going the fiscal way could also be useful. Actually, we saw that spread fell in 2020 during the COVID crisis in two occasions. First, of course, when the ECB launched the PPP, and then actually when we started talking about more fiscal integration, and actually spreads fell really quickly when there was the Franco-German proposal, which was then materialized into the July 2020 Council proposal for NGU. But so I think, yeah, the two are important. The ECB's role is very, very important in my view. But it's true that showing that we want to stick together through fiscal programs is also a way to reassure markets. And actually, if you have NGU, type of programs where you have like redistributive programs that could help countries that actually are also the ones where spread are increasing, it could help their sustainability also. So it could also help them with spreads.
That's quite interesting, because remember when Madame Lagarde said at the beginning of the pandemic, was in March 2020, that we're not here to control spreads. Remember this? Of course, this didn't go down very well. But effectively, what you're saying is about, you know, it's not really the monetary policy that will do that. It is other things that are going to reduce the financial fragmentation, right? And then to pretend that it is the central bank's role to actually manage that as well may be wrong. So what we're looking for, and I think what you're both alluding to, is better macroeconomic coordination, right? The age of macroeconomic coordination is back. And the question is how to do it in an architectural structure, which has got 19 central bankers in the board. So, you know, we're coming back to the perennial problem of that, which is, of course, an architectural issue. So moving forward, and without, I mean, it's interesting what you said, Megan, about the independence of the ECB, that it's actually less problematic than it is in the case of the Fed. I mean, I found that a little bit, not counterintuitive, but perhaps paradoxical, because, you know, maybe the problem in the EU is that it's a little bit maybe too independent. Does that make sense, that the ECB is too independent? Can that be a problem?
So, no, I'm not worried about the ECB being too independent. But given that there's no fiscal authority and that to do anything requires so much coordination, I think the risk of, you know, anyone being able to tell the ECB what it should do and what to buy is much lower than in the US, where Congress can just decide. And that's that. They can change the treaty if they want. They can change the Fed's mandate if they want. They can say, you know, the Fed knows that if they, for example, subsidize the green transition and in the way I was suggesting the ECB can do, there's a good chance, you know, the White House or Congress can turn around and say, well, now fund a wall or now fund anything. And there's nothing the Fed can do. For the ECB, that's much less likely because there's no single authority that can make that decision. You have to, you know, agree among all these member states and the board, and it's just much more difficult.
So let's talk a little bit about the risks, right? And so forth, because we are to the extent that we can measure the risk. It's interesting to see that the ECB has first of all stopped talking about fund charge, so there's no probabilities in the forecast anymore. In the last forecast round, the 10th of March, and actually the Commission as well, they did not present a baseline and then scenarios on either side, so as a risk scenario and an opportune scenario. They provide a baseline and then two bad scenario. So I think we are already sort of understanding that the risks are very skewed on the downside, right, when it comes to the outlook. In particular for inflation, the debate on, I know, Meg, you're very, very much on one side of this argument on whether the inflation permanent versus inflation temporary. But can we really think about sort of a temporary inflation? I noticed Gregory used the word durable, which I think means maybe here for long, and if it's not permanent, but here for some time, that is of real headache. How do you see this debate, let's say, in the next 2 years, which, by the way, are also the policy horizon for any monetary authority, right?
Yeah. So I think me saying temporary and Gregory saying durable actually means the same thing. I think using the phrase temporary or transitory hasn't been particularly intellectually honest of us economists, because most of us haven't said how long that will last. And I think it could last at least another year, which some people wouldn't define as temporary or transitory. For what it's worth, I think in the US, actually, the Fed almost pulled it off. So the Fed did believe that it was transitory, even though they've, you know, retired the word now. But they felt like they were supply side issues. And towards the end of last year, we really saw signs of global supply chain stress abating. So we saw order backlogs, you know, increasing less slowly. We saw supplier delivery times starting to come down. We also saw, and this is an issue the US has, but the Eurozone doesn't, that, you know, a labor supply issue starting to debate. So the labor force participation rate was ticking up. People were moving from retirement back into the labor force, for example. Those who were worried about COVID started to jump back into the labor force. So it seems like some of those supply issues were abating. And then Russia invaded Ukraine and Omicron hit China. And so I think it was, you know, some bad luck, actually. And I think that bad luck will persist for at least another year. Unfortunately, I don't see China getting rid of its zero COVID policy before the November Party Congress. And I don't see this war actually clearing up anytime soon. And given the problems with, you know, fertilizer exports, even if the war did clear up immediately, there would be long-lasting effects on food prices in particular. So, you know, I think I still believe that inflation is transitory. And I think the Fed really does at its core as well. But transitory could last another year, maybe 2 years. And you know, so if it's transitory, that doesn't mean you don't do anything about it, because the implications for people's standard of living are pretty severe, both in the US and in the Eurozone. I mean, you're seeing a real cost of living crisis on both sides of the Atlantic. And so policymakers have an obligation to try to do something about that. I just think that fiscal authorities might be better placed to help with that than central banks, actually. So things like in Spain, you're seeing energy subsidies. We don't have those in the US, but you know, maybe we'll come up with something similar. I think that's more effective than hiking rates and trying to kill off demand effectively. I mean, I know in the US, the Fed's only managed to generate 3 soft landings in its history. Every other rate hiking cycle has ended up in a recession. So the Fed's record is really bad on trying to engineer a soft landing. And notably, unemployment is much lower this time around than any of those 3 other times when it managed to generate a soft landing, which suggests, you know, the Fed's going to have a really hard time doing this. It won't be so different for the ECB, I think, trying to get at supply issues using demand management tools that are blunt and, you know, kick in with a lag without causing a recession is going to be really difficult.
I think it's great that Megan mentioned fiscal policy, because I think, contrary to other past episodes of high inflation, I think fiscal policy has to play an important role in that one. I think, actually, if you look at Eurozone countries, most of the difference in inflation between countries can be explained by fiscal policy and the way that fiscal policy has played a role. For instance, in France, fiscal policy has helped a lot, actually, because they have been trying to shield vulnerable households from inflation with price caps, subsidies, vouchers, etc. And this has reduced inflation a lot. Actually, inflation in France is only at 5%, which is much lower than the Eurozone average, and much lower than inflation in other countries, even like Belgium, which is just the neighbor of France, and which is structurally a bit the same in terms of energy, like they both have like nuclear energy, etc. So I'm not talking about Estonia, which obviously depend on Russian gas. But if you look at, for instance, the difference between France, Belgium, and Italy, actually fiscal policy played an important role in France in reducing inflation. And I think actually this could also help the ECB, because if inflation is lower thanks to fiscal policy, it means that expectation disanchoring is less likely to happen than in the case where you have like 10% inflation. So I think, yeah, fiscal policy could actually play an important role in the current episode.
In managing the supply shock effectively. And I think that makes sense if monetary policy cannot do it. But Greg, because we're discussing the risks, and I think certainly in Europe, in the euro area, these are not negligible, right? And the European Commission is about to come up tomorrow with a new package of sanctions, the 6th. This one is going to be much more on sort of, you know, the private assets that could be seized, which is, I mean, I don't know how economically significant it is. But let's rest on the 5th package on the oil, on the possibility of imposing oil sanctions. And we know how difficult this discussion is in the euro area. I mean, basically decoupling instantly, abruptly from Russia on oil and gas. I think on gas is probably a no-go area. On oil, we still have disagreements. We see what Hungary, whether we can find a way of not taking Hungary on board. These are the bits that will make a difference in terms of effectiveness of sanctions. But at the same time, what would they imply for the growth numbers, right? I mean, I think things need to get a lot worse before they become better. On the growth outlook, if we impose sanctions, the tougher they are, the more we feel into the economy. And it will take some time before prices come down because, you know, the economically speaking, our dependence on energy is going to increase. And I mean, the elasticity of price will have to sort of, will be much more sensitive to sanctions. So do you share my pessimism that things need to go a lot worse on both growth and inflation, so, you know, the opposite direction movement, before we can really talk about normalization?
No, I fully share your view. And actually, this debate is taking place mainly in Germany, where there is debate about like even elasticity of substitution, etc., towards different type of energy. However, if you look at the forecasts that these people are making, they are still quite low. Like they say that, okay, a decoupling from Russia instantaneously would lead to a reduced output by 3%. It's not that much. If we want to show that we are serious about sanction, we should be ready to lose 3% of GDP in a way. Russia might lose like 10 to 20% of its GDP, and we are not ready to lose 2 to 3%. I think it shows that we are not serious about the sanction if we don't do it.
No, but I mean, you know, irrespective of whether we should or shouldn't do it, the fact is that if we were to do it and get a 3% cut or whatever, it's still going to be a much... Then you're really in stagflation territory. Yeah, but I mean, I happen to agree with you that this is the price worth taking, also because it reduces the timing of all of this. I mean, God knows how long this is going to last for. But the fact is that if you were to implement those sanctions, you're going to take an instant hit. Megan?
Yeah, no, I agree. And for Europe, obviously, this is much more difficult than for the US, which is a net energy exporter, and where energy costs were already lower. But for what it's worth, you know, I thought both Europe and the US were facing an energy crisis before Russia invaded Ukraine. And, you know, and that's an out of consensus view, particularly on the U.S. side, given we're net energy exporters. But, you know, there's been chronic underinvestment in fossil fuels starting in 2014, when you had the Thanksgiving Day massacre. And, you know, now I think energy companies would probably be punished for capital investment by investors. And so instead, they're just paying out dividends. So that just affects the supply side. And that was before Russia invaded Ukraine. Every energy analyst I spoke to in the US in January of this year, so again, before the Ukrainian war, said to me, oil will go to $150 a barrel this year. You know, maybe not in a sustained way, but it will spike to that, certainly, because we just haven't had any investment. Notably, last year, energy equities were some of the best performing in the US, and no institutional money went into those companies, in part as well because of the ESG movement. So, you know, that's an intended result, but actually there are implications. And so, you know, a lot of analysts were really pinning their hopes on an Iran nuclear deal to bring Iranian oil onto the market. That's obviously fallen apart. So I think we were already facing a tough environment for energy in both the EU and in the US, and now it's just gotten much worse. But there were, you know, there are fundamental reasons why we were going to face higher energy costs. And so this isn't really invigorated the green transition in Europe, I think. In the US, the first question I was asked when Russia invaded Ukraine by a number of investors was, we're going to reopen the Keystone pipeline, right? So the knee-jerk reaction in the US was, you know, forget the green transition. We need to invest more in fossil fuels. The response has been different in Europe for obvious reasons, given how reliant Europe is on Russia for energy. But I do think there, you know, we'll see how that debate plays out, whether we need to make the green transition faster or slow it down. I think it will play out differently on different sides of the Atlantic.
My sense is that, well, I mean, I think the very short run, but which is a way of dealing with the decoupling, is going to push us back on the green objectives because we're opening up coal mines. And, you know, all of the, this is happening to some extent as well in Europe because the short term is so imminent, right? And the inflationary pressures are so imminent. But in terms of medium term, I think it will be accelerating the green transition. I think that much is real. But of course, what will happen in the interim in terms of private investments, and I think that goes to the point that you made, Megan, is that, you know, that you're not going to have private investments on sorting out short-term and medium-term problems. That the investments need kind of a long-term security there. So there's going to be an interesting fiscal policy, which comes back to Gregory's point. The role for fiscal policy is going to be even more imminent. Now, we'll have you back for another conversation on the fiscal points, but I think this is all we have time for today. Listen, it's been absolutely wonderful having you both. Thank you for giving us both sides of the Atlantic views. We are certainly hoping for better days. For the moment, we're all hoping that the war will be contained and finished as much as possible. It's good for Ukraine, it's good for the world. And beyond that, we need to sort out some of the economic implications. Listen, Bill, thank you very much, Megan, Gregory, for joining us today in The Sound of Economics. For you, the viewers, thank you for joining us today. You will find all our products on our website, www.bruegel.org. Join us for another episode of The Sound of Economics. For just now, thank you and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.